I'm here with Dr. Jeff Meldrum. He's a professor of anatomy and anthropology with expertise in the study of human adaptations for walking on two legs. So how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you.
Good. So I understand that you are going to be coming and speaking at a conference in Pocatello on Bigfoot and Sasquatch.
That's right. That's right. A friend of mine, Brandon Tennant, who's a proprietor of Falling Rock Productions, a print company, and Sasquatch Prints is his own label, has organized an intimate event, about 120 seats, and there aren't many tickets left, so hurry. And three speakers actually, Cliff Berrickman, one of the cast members of Finding Bigfoot, very successful cable documentary series there, and will also be speaking, and Becky Cook, another Idaho native, who has collected quite a gathering of stories, of anecdotes, people's experiences here in Idaho, and has written a couple of books, Bigfoot Lives in Idaho and Bigfoot Still Lives in Idaho. And of course, I'll be speaking, and I'll be talking about the significance of the Patterson-Gimlin film, which has often been dismissed based on, you know, kind of telegraph game style rumors that go around the mill, and sort of superficial discounting of what stands still as one of the most significant pieces of photographic evidence, and especially with 2020 hindsight, after 50 years, looking back on it now with what we know in anthropology and human evolution, the hominid fossil record and so forth, we can look back at that film and better understand why it wasn't accepted by the scientific community at that time, and ways in which it actually has anticipated our current understanding of human evolution, what it was to be an early hominid, say, and what we see on that screen is remarkably prescient of our current understanding of that phase of our history, prehistory.
And is that also kind of what you talk about in your book?
That's one aspect. Yes, the book, Sasquatch Legend Meets Science, is very broad, has a wide scope of evidence that indicates that, in fact, there may be something out there. And it draws upon not only my own experiences over the past decade at the time of the writing of that book, but the documentary upon which it was based or grew out of recruited experts, scientists from many different disciplines, from the study of bioacoustics to hair analysis to fingerprint analysis to all sorts of different types of evidence, DNA, molecular anthropology, and the opinions of those experts regarding the various types of evidence, short of course, a body, short of a type specimen to actually provide conclusive evidence that such a creature exists. But short of that, there's remarkably suggestive and even compelling evidence. You know, from my perspective, the evidence of the footprint casts and photos are extremely persuasive. I mean, it's more incredible at this point. I mean, I have over 300 footprint casts in my lab, and the remarkably consistent model of the distinctive nature of the Sasquatch foot, elegantly adapted to bipedalism in a very large, heavy, you know, nearly 1,000-pound bipedal primate, is remarkably compelling. It's almost more incredible to suggest that these are just simple hoaxes, which is the common appeal of the skeptics. It's more incredible to suggest that than it is to at least acknowledge the possibility that, hey, there really might be something out there. So let's look at the likelihood and look at the evidence on its own merits rather than based on some preconception we have of what can and cannot exist.
Right. And when you say, when you're talking about these feet, obviously that's your field of expertise. Mm-hmm. What about them is so compelling?
Mm-hmm. Well, they're not just simply the product of a ridiculously crude carved wooden foot strapped to a hiking boot or a logging boot, as some would have us believe. They're also not just simply enlarged facsimiles of a human foot. They show remarkable distinctions, notable distinctions, that are absolutely appropriate. They're biomechanically sound and correlated for the manner of walking that would be employed by a big, heavy, bipedal primate navigating rugged, steep, broken terrain in the mountainous forests of Western North America primarily. And so they're broader than a human foot. They're, relatively broader, as well as absolutely. They're flat instead of having a fixed longitudinal arch, which their weight just simply would not accommodate. But they've retained a degree of midfoot flexibility that was present in our forebears and in our close relatives amongst the great apes. They've lost the divergent thumb-like big toe, but have retained much greater prehension and length, relative length of the toes, in order to grip and navigate that irregular surfaces of the mountainous forested habitats that they're reported to occupy.
So they're flat. They don't have an arch,
right,
from what I understand, and they have longer toes than we
yep.
do, but not like a big toe.
But the big toe looks more like ours in that it's aligned with the other digits. It doesn't stick out like a thumb on a chimpanzee foot,
right.
Which means they're not climbing in trees. I mean, at least not they're not arboreal or tree dwelling like the other primates are. I mean, that's one of the most distinctive characteristics of the primate order is this thumb-like big toe that allows them a grasping. The foot to function as a grasping organ as well as a propulsive organ. Commitment to walking on the ground, one no longer needs that. And the primitive condition is to have the less divergent big toe and lined up with the other digits. But, I mean, they're, you know, as exemplified in many of their footprints, never having been confined in shoe wear, their toes show remarkable ability to splay and to diverge in that sense. The point is, in the casts that I have, there's ample examples of repeat appearances of individuals that demonstrate remarkable animation of the toes, that vary with the conditions of the substrate and the way in which the creature is progressing and so on. I mean, these are not just... to suggest that these have all been produced by carved wooden feet strapped to the boots is just inane. I mean, it's just it's completely ignorant of the data that we currently have. And the family, the Wallace family, despite my repeated requests, won't even let me examine and measure and photograph their fake feet. It'd be very straightforward to take those carved wooden feet that they claim they have, many of. We've only seen a couple of them in the press, but to measure and photograph them and easily, if that were the case, to match them up to this footprint record that has accumulated over the decades and discount some or all of the footprints as being produced by these carved wooden feet. But they won't do that. They won't do that. Just simply, and it's obvious why, because even the examples that they have, the one that's gotten the most press is clearly copied from existing footprint casts. Not exactly, but you can tell what inspired these particular examples, which are very different than the typical carved wooden foot that Ray Wallace used to produce with remarkably flat plank line, sharp edges, toes looking like Easter eggs in an egg carton, lined straight with a ruler across the end of the foot. They're silly. It amazes me that people have been so willing to accept such a ridiculously simplistic and inane explanation for a very intriguing, very complicated, very technical body of data.
And I am not as familiar with this Wallace family as you're talking about it. Are they people who are saying all of these footprints are made from wooden
Right.
Wouldn't
well,
you?
I almost regret even bringing it up, giving them any further information. But yes, one of the patriarch of the family, Ray Wallace, was a road builder down in Northern California. And about the time that, as they were cutting roads back into the wilderness of Northern California, which back in the 50s was, you know, you might as well have been in the Himalayas just about. It was really remote and very rugged and very inaccessible. And as they put these roads back in, these footprints started to show up. Well, the rumor began then that it was Ray Wallace and his brother Shorty, Wilbur Wallace, that were responsible for making these footprints just as a prank, just to joke around with people. Although he would complain that, you know, his workers were so frightened of these gigantic footprints and all the antics that accompanied them, like 55-gallon barrels of diesel fuel being pitched into the ravine and things like that, trailers full of culverts turned over on their sides, you know, upside down, things that would have required remarkable feats of strength. I talked to one witness, myself, who, when they were up in the hills looking for more footprints, they found one of these bundles of cable, the cable that were used to tie down the culverts, these great big culverts they would use to put underneath the roads for the streams to go through. They would bundle up these thick cables, you know, and each one weighed about 150 pounds when it was all bundled up. And here was one a mile and a half up the side of the mountain in, you know, off-road, off-trail. And, you know, they looked at that and they thought, how in the world did this end up here? And who would possibly do that just as a joke and in a place where the chances of someone finding it are just about nil? Of course, someone did find it, so that argument's not the best. But the point was, when Ray Wallace passed, his family came forward, and in a feigned admission that, in fact, they were responsible for the legend of Bigfoot. And not only had they stomped out all these wooden footprints using these ridiculously crude wooden feet, but that their mother was in the costume that appears in the Patterson-Gimlin film that I'll be talking about.
Oh.
Well, their mother's 5'2", and whatever's in that film was at least 6.5 to 7 feet tall. And it probably weighed, based on the volume that you can see and the remarkable depth of the footprints, you know, anywhere from 600 to 800 pounds. And so to suggest that this little dainty 5'2" woman was the subject of this film is just so incredible. it's comical to consider that people are taking that kind of claim seriously. You can't look at the film, and I'll emphasize that in my talk. You can't look at it without being impressed. If you're familiar with wildlife, if you've been around livestock, you've seen how they move, you've seen how their muscles move beneath the skin and so forth, you can see all those details and more, much more than people are often exposed to on the television broadcast versions of the film, which are very, you know, very faded and deteriorated and scratched and so forth, copies of the film. But, to bring it back around, we'll talk about the Patterson-Gimlin film and all of the aspects that are remarkably compelling, that, hey, there really is something out there that continues to be seen by credible, sober, sound witnesses and leaves its trace and physical evidence behind in the form of footprints and hair that defies identifications, vocalizations that can't be attributed to common forms of wildlife, and so on. It's a remarkable mystery, but an intriguing scientific investigation.
And how did you start becoming more interested and start believing more?
Right. Well, as I said, my expertise, my principal research as an academic is the history of the pattern and process by which we have come to walk on two legs, and how especially our lower extremities are adapted to that, the foot foremost. And so I've studied fossilized footprints in Hawaii and in Africa and all around the world, examples of such, and I've looked at the foot skeleton, the fossilized foot skeleton of our early hominid ancestors, as well as, like I said, our close relatives amongst the great apes from many, many sites around the world. And so with that background, I was brought up in face-to-face with a long line of very fresh tracks of 15-inch footprints in southeastern Washington. And this was in 1996. And this was an exceptional example. The conditions were great. It had been raining over the weekend. The roads were muddy, very silty. We're down in southeastern Washington, much like much of Idaho, southern Idaho. There's that very fine luss, that glacial silt that when it's wet, it's very clayey. And so it takes a footprint with remarkable detail. These tracks were so fresh when I knelt down beside them, you could still see the skin ridge detail from the bottom of the foot transferred to the footprint. And it was fading fast in this drizzly weather we were experiencing, but it was they were that fresh. They must have been laid down, you know, literally hours prior to our examining them. And it took me aback. I at the time was quite skeptical after years and years, you know, having grown up in the Pacific Northwest, having seen the film back in 1968, its premiere showing in Spokane, Washington, when I was a little kid. And all that time, the mystery had not been solved to conclusively. And so here I was examining these footprints from a perspective of expertise and experience that gave me probably more insight into what the significance of them was than many other people, most other people. So that was that kind of set the hook, I guess you could say. And so now here we are 22 years later, and as I said, 300 footprint casts and hundreds of photographs of alleged footprints attributed to Sasquatch, Bigfoot, are here in my lab and form the basis of my study of and analysis of, inference of, the foot form and function attributable to Sasquatch. And so it's, this is what we mean by legend meets science. The stories, I was once accosted by a past department chair who said, "Well, after all, Jeff, these are just stories." And I said, "Well, stories that leave footprints, that shed hair, that void scat, that vocalize, that have been witnessed by intelligent, sober, experienced outdoorsmen and hunters and agency personnel." I said that it's a lot more than just a story. And so here we are. So I think it'll be a great opportunity this weekend for people to hear some of what I have to say about the Patterson-Gimlin film. I think Cliff Berkman is going to talk about, as a member, a cast member of Finding Bigfoot, whether you like the show or not. he became quite a lightning rod, and he's been very, very collegial in sharing his information with me, and vice versa. We've been good friends for many, many years, long before he was on Finding Bigfoot, and he'll be talking about some of the latest developments, some things that have come to his attention, that are kind of intriguing and interesting bits of evidence. And so it'll be a good combination of the historical perspective brought into the contemporary, and then what are some of the latest pieces of evidence that have been laid on the table for consideration.
That's great. I just have two more questions.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered, when people post fake videos, like the one that was in Idaho a couple of years ago with the drone, what does that do for people like you in that community?
Right. Well, each experience, each prank, it has its own repercussions and ramifications. In this case, I mean, it was so obvious. If you stopped and looked at it and you considered the circumstances and the context in which it was portrayed, it was obviously a hoax. And I said as such. And in fact, I took flack from members of the Bigfoot community for being negative about, without, in such short order. But it was obvious. And so I was quite bemused when, literally a couple of days later, the prankster, realizing the impact of his actions and the potential repercussions, posted a, sort of a retraction by recreating the same video clip, essentially the same shot, only instead of running into the forest, the fellow in the ridiculous costume stops, bends down, picks up a great big poster board, and turns around. And I can't remember now what it said, but it said something like "fooled you" or something, or "gotcha." and then the folks that were the most vocal in criticizing me had egg on their face. but I mean, it demonstrated that if you don't react emotionally, if you react objectively and analytically, and have a basis for your position, then it's you can go about it scientifically. I always get I'm always a bit annoyed when one of the most famous skeptics, Michael Shermer, one of his mantras is the science starts once you have a body. Show me the body. Well, okay, yes, to conclusively demonstrate the existence of a new species, it does require a body or a type specimen, a piece that's diagnostic. But to say that the science starts once you have a body is the most ridiculous, utterly unscientific statement I've ever heard. The science starts when you have a question. The science is about the methodology of investigating a question. And, you asked me earlier, how did I come to believe? Well, I always, when I'm asked that, I usually push right back and say, well, I don't believe. It's not a matter of belief. When the average person says, oh, I believe in that, they've come to accept something for whatever reason. But usually it's in the absence of any conclusive or even persuasive evidence. You accept the existence of God, and you may have evidence in your own personal experience in life, but that is very highly subjective. I don't believe. Oh, and I wanted to add that, people like Michael Shermer would heap the label true believer on people who he looks down, at as not being critical thinking and so forth. So I don't believe in Bigfoot, but I'm convinced that Bigfoot or Sasquatch exists on the basis of the evidence. I don't accept it. I don't hold a conviction in the absence of evidence, but I'm convinced on the basis of the evidence. And that's how science proceeds. You evaluate the evidence, you modify your hypothesis until such time as you can conclusively demonstrate, your proposition. And we're not there yet, but we can proceed scientifically, and we should. I mean, any scientist worth his salt should be amazed at the possibility that there are relic species of hominoid or hominin even that have persisted into the present alongside our own species. What an interesting, fascinating proposition. When the hobbit, Homo floresiensis, was discovered in Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, and it was initially dated to be only 12,000, 13,000 years old. It's been pushed back a little bit, but not by much. I mean, that was headline news. Well, gee, wouldn't you think that the discovery of or the recognition of a large bipedal primate in North America in our own backyard would be headline news? And instead of just offhandedly, dismissively, eliminating the possibility, rejecting the possibility, they can't exist, therefore they don't, the attitude that I sometimes run into. What about looking at the evidence and thinking, well, how could we go about this question even more incisively? How could we get that conclusive or evidence for or against the existence?
And my last question, I think that we probably maybe already answered it with that the question beforehand, but I was going to say, like many people don't believe or are very skeptical of the existence of a Sasquatch, but how do you respond to those people?
Oh, well, that's fine. I mean, skepticism is fine if it's tempered with objectivity. I mean, the skeptics can be as extreme. In fact, in my opinion, anyone who calls themselves a skeptic is too extreme. if you have to, if you're wearing that one principle of scientific inquiry on your sleeve, you know, like a red armband, then you've gone too far. Skepticism should be one thread in that tapestry of inquiry into the unknown. Those people who say, well, they don't believe, then no, that's fine. They can, if they don't want to make the effort to weigh and examine the evidence, if they want to just hold an opinion based on a vacuous belief system or a baseless opinion, then that's their prerogative. I mean, that's fine. But there are lots of people. I mean, there's huge interest. Those people are actually the minority. And there's, not to say that that everyone just, accepts everything on face, but there's huge interest, and which is indicated by the popularity of shows like Finding Bigfoot, and the fact that, you know, there will be many, many people, and I'm afraid that we'll be turning some away from the door who haven't purchased tickets ahead of time because of the huge interest in this topic, especially regionally. And those are just inquisitive minds. They're admittedly, there's a mystique, there's a fascination with anything that's mysterious and unfathomed. But there's also this interest in the possibility that there are still things yet to be discovered, that we haven't found all the answers. And, you know, for me, that's what science is all about. Science and exploration go hand in hand. Doing research on a question that you pretty much know the answer to is kind of boring for me. I mean, for some people, that's fine. Let them; they're welcome to do it. But I would rather be out on the margins and pushing that envelope of knowledge a little further, exploring the fringe.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Meldrum.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Again, that's Dr. Jeff Meldrum, a professor at ISU. Professor of Anthropology and Anatomy with expertise on the study of human adaptation for walking on two legs. He'll be speaking at the Sasquatch Convention in Pocatello on Friday and Saturday.